since I began my, well, third or fourth career, depending on how you count. And I'm constantly on the road. I blocked out the dates on my calendar to be sure that I could attend my daughter Gabby's graduation from her small school at Berkeley High on June 5th with 200 graduates on the front end, and the whole school senior class commencement of Berkeley High with 800 kids in her class on June 13th on the back end. Beautifully, miraculously, June 11th, today, fit right in the middle. It was all gonna work out. That was back when the world was normal, less than 6 months ago. Fast forward. By the middle of March, it had become abundantly apparent that all of my plans, and way more importantly, all of your plans, were likely not to be. I sent an email to Sharon and Rebecca suggesting we set a time to talk. They agreed. Slight diversion. By this point, I was sheltering in place at our second home on the northern Sonoma coast. With a bout of pneumonia only a year behind me, and two autoimmune conditions, one of which is alopecia, which you can see by the fact that I have no hair on my head, and no, it's not by choice, my doctor strongly advised that I get out of Dodge, in this case, Berkeley, fast. And so on March 16th, my life partner, Peg, our youngest daughter, Gabby, the senior at Berkeley High, and our foreign exchange student from Germany, Esther, piled into our cars and drove 2.5 hours north. Within a matter of days, two things became abundantly apparent. First, Esther's year abroad living with us would be cut short. She would have to go back to Germany soon. Second, the despondency and despair of the inevitable loss of so many rites of passage at the end of Gabby's high school career had begun to take hold, and the isolation of this space, so good for me, was so terrible for her. As I set out to share some thoughts with you this evening, I want to say that while I don't know most of you, I can relate. As the parent of a high school senior, class of 2020, I can relate. As a graduate of this amazing school, I can relate. My hope is that you find in something of what I say here tonight, something you can relate to. One of my professors at Stanford advised me before my oral defense, tell them what you're gonna say, then say it, then remind them of what you said. So in homage to this professor, in this talk, which I hope will be followed by some rich conversation, I hope to take you on a journey akin to the one we just traversed between Pesach and Shavuot. The journey I hope to take you on starts with Yitzhak Mitzrayim, our exodus from Egypt, moves on to the Omer, where I will talk about counting, then on to Matan Torah, and ends with redemption. In this case, a charge for the future, your future. Because I was told all good commencement speeches must have a charge at the end. So let's see how I do. In chapter 12 of Shmot, we learn about the Israelites' exodus from Egypt. The text states, V'gam erev rav ala itam, v'tzonu vakar miknek haved me'od. And a mixed multitude went up also with them, and flocks and herds, even very much cattle. A mixed multitude also went up out of Egypt with them, the Israelites. The Torah, which as you know, is at best a Spartan document with so much left open for inference and filling in, for some reason goes to the trouble of telling us in this most propitious moment of our collective history that we left Egypt along with a part of a mixed multitude, an Erev Rav. What could this possibly mean? Rashi, compelled to comment on the phrase Erev Rav, says that Erev Rav was Ta'arovet Umot Shel Gerim, that is, a mingling of various nations of converts to Judaism. Ibn Ezra, one of Rashi's contemporaries, takes a different tack. He contends that the Erev Rav were Egyptians, non-Jews, and non-converts, who had, in Egypt, been mixed in with the Israelites. He uses the word ha'asaf suf, which has been translated by many as riffraff, but actually comes from the Hebrew word le'asof, or to gather, meaning those that were gathered among them, which is a much friendlier and, I dare say, more accurate translation of the word. While these two readings are pretty much descriptive and inasmuch positive reading and rendering of the text, it turns out that most of the rabbis of the Midrash and Talmud tend to disfavor the Erev Rav, the mixed multitude, scapegoating them for any number of failings and backslidings by the Israelites during their desert wandering. These failings and backslidings include, on the most severe end, the making of the Egel Zahav, the golden calf, as they, the mixed multitude, collectively stood at Sinai. To the more general protests of complaints and ingratitude expressed by Bnei Israel all along the 40-year journey. They kvetched a lot. Aside from Rashi and Ibn Ezra, so far, our view of the Erev Rav, the mixed multitude, is not a pretty one. It gets worse. It gets much worse. Chaim Vital, an influential 16th century Kabbalist who was a student of the famed Isaac Luria, went so far as to state in Sefer HaLikutin that, quote, the essence of sin of Adam was that he wanted to draw near to him the mixed multitude. And Moses followed the same pattern when he drew to him the mixed multitude. And they destroyed and degraded the yoke by making the calf, and we are still in exile and will not be redeemed until we are cleansed and purified from them. There are many, many more texts and examples I could bring of how this negative and disparaging view of the Erev Rav, the mixed multitude, has been pervasive in our collective consciousness, persisting through millennia, even into contemporary times. Suffice it to say, our sages and our community have struggled with, have had mixed emotions about our mixed multitudeness since our very beginnings. That's our moment of exodus. Now I want to turn to Omer, to counting. Judaism, it turns out, has tons of rules about counting. Who gets counted, what gets counted, how we count or don't. Our liturgy, our laws, and our lore are filled with them. A biggie is that we're actually not supposed to count Jews. As the prophet Hosea says, and the number of the children of Israel shall be as the sand of the sea, which shall neither be measured nor counted. But we do. The first attempt to estimate the Jewish population in the U.S. in the post-World War II era was in 1957, when a single question was added to the U.S. Census Bureau's CPS, or Current Population Survey. In the survey, respondents, or subjects, as they were called back in the day, were presented with a voluntary, open-ended, think, write-in, fill-in-the-blank, question that read, "What is your religion?" That's it. The year 1970 marked the first national Jewish population study in the U.S., sponsored by what was then called the Council of Jewish Federations, now the Jewish Federations of North America. The demographers, those who study such things like populations, had to tackle definitional questions of both who counts and what is worthy of counting for the sake of, well, counting the Jews. A fairly extensive set of questions was used to determine if the respondent was born Jewish, is now Jewish, and whether the mother, father, grandparent, etc. of the respondent was born Jewish. One question on marital status assumed heteronormativity. A second did ask about the spouse's religion, suggesting a recognition that perhaps a Jew could be married to a non-Jew. A single question on gender was limited to a binary response, male or female. Two things stand out. First, the survey acknowledged and included those who converted to Judaism. Second, the survey seemed to acknowledge that someone who counted as Jewish could have only one Jewish parent, not two. This study was perhaps an initial recognition that estimates of the Jewish population in the U.S. ought to take into account some aspects of our mixed multitudeness, our Erev Rav. However, questions on race, ethnicity, and sexual orientation were absent. The next national Jewish population study, sponsored again by the Federation Movement, took place in 1989-1990. The question on gender was still binary. There were still a couple of questions on conversion, and we continued to ask questions about in-marriage and intermarriage. The demographers added their first question on Jewish ethnicity, asking respondents to state whether they consider themselves Ashkenazi, Sephardi, or something else. Included on the list of something else, if you chose that answer, was Russian Jewish, just Jewish, non or none, Christian, not Jewish, mixed, Hasidic / Lubavitch / Chabad, American, Reform, miscellaneous/other, a bizarre set of choices. Still no question on sexual orientation, still no question on race. Sadly, pretty much all of the interesting findings from the 1989-1990 NJPS were totally eclipsed by one single data point, the now infamous 52% intermarriage rate. This set off a firestorm in the broader U.S. Jewish community with the establishment of Jewish continuity commissions all around the country, whose sole purpose was to stem the tide of intermarriage. It seems that most, but not all, of our communal policymakers decided that our mixed multitudeness, our Erev Rav, had simply gone too far, and now was the time to act. A few things happened in the wake of that NJPS report, which came out in 1992. First, Birthright Israel was born in 1994, the brainchild of two Jewish megadonors, Charles Bronfman and Michael Steinhardt. According to one narrative, Birthright Israel was brought into existence to bridge what was purported to be a growing distancing between US and Israeli Jews. According to another narrative, the one I would put more stock in as a student of such things, it was brought into existence to get young Jews on a boondoggle for 10 days so they could meet other young Jews, marry them, have more Jewish babies, and thus stem the tide of intermarriage and a shrinking Jewish population if you count only what the demographers called the core. 2 years later, in 1996, Keshet, the national organization working for the full equality of LGBTQ Jews and their families in Jewish life, was born. 1 year after that, in 1997, Interfaith Family, now 18 Doors, was born. Our mixed emotions about our mixed multitudeness came into sharper relief. The NJPS was conducted once again, it turns out, for a final time in 2000-2001. By this point, you're all born. Digging into parentage and lineage to establish one's Jewish credit, actually, you're not all born yet, but yes, you are. You're just born. Digging into parentage and lineage to establish one's Jewish credentials for the converts among us was, thankfully, less obtrusive. Questions about in-marriage and intermarriage continued. Gender was still binary. Still no question on sexual orientation. The ethnicity question was actually dropped, and for the first time, our demographers included a question on race. In the end of the day, the biggest takeaway from the 2000-2001 NJPS was, well, that Hosea was right after all. The Jews should stop counting the Jews. Not because God had decreed it, not because the prophet had prophesied it, not because the rabbis later came up with all sorts of other reasons like counting brings on the Ayin Hara, but, well, frankly, because the Jewish demographers got into a big fight about how best to count, and the Federation movement decided that the whole enterprise was no longer worth the time, money, or headache. Oy. The final chapter to date in our Omer, our counting story, is the Portrait of Jewish Americans, a report of the Pew Research Center for Religion and Public Life released in 2013. This now often quoted study introduced us to the religious nones, that's N-O-N-E-S, the cultural, as distinct from the religious, Jews, a 58% intermarriage, 71% if you exclude those who self-identify as Orthodox, and an estimation that 6% of our community is comprised of Jews of color. Some scholars of American Jewish life today say that that number may be as high as 15% due to undercounting or not counting. 3 years later, in 2016, the Jews of Color Field Building Initiative was founded. Our Erev Rav, our mixed multitude, was expanding. That's the end of my Omer, the part of this journey that focuses on counting. I now want to turn our attention to the next part of this journey, to Matan Torah, the gift of teaching, the gift of showing. One of the main findings of the 89-90 NJPS that got eclipsed by the 52% intermarriage rate was that having a Jewish day school education is one of the strongest predictors of becoming a deeply connected, committed, and involved Jewish adult. In fact, later analyses of the data show that 7+ years of Jewish day school education was pretty much the secret sauce for for ensuring such an outcome. All I'll say here is that thank God you people figured out how to have one sixth grade and not two, because now everyone can have 7 years at Barrick. But I digress. I believe the founders of Akiba Hebrew Academy, and here for a while I am going to use the school's original name, harbored this belief. It was their anchor in a stormy sea of criticism lodged against them and their successors during the school's early years. This criticism primarily revolved around the notion that day schools were un-American, separating and segregating Jewish students from other American youth, that that was a bad thing. Permit me to take a personal digression here. I am the youngest of three kids in my family, and my brother and sister are on this Zoom call tonight. My brother and sister attended Samuel L. Gompers for elementary school because my father firmly believed that Jewish day schools were insular, un-American, and otherwise not good for the Jews, and especially not good for his kids. My mother, who's also here tonight, she's 89 and a half, firmly believed the opposite. By the time I was kindergarten ready, my parents had divorced and my mother enrolled me in Solomon Schechter. She was a fierce believer in Jewish day school education and did everything in her power to make sure that it was there I stayed for all 12 years. She's 89 and a half and she's listening in this evening from her apartment in Cherry Hill. To her, I wanna say, I knew I was gonna get choked up this part. Thank you for the gift of a Jewish day school education. It made me who I am today. Okay, back to the narrative of Matan Torah, the gift of teaching. What made Akiba extra special then and continues through Barrick today is its commitment to Jewish pluralism and inclusivity. Unbeknownst to me, before I started working on this speech, Dr. Harold Gorvine, or Groovy Gorvy, as we affectionately called this constantly disheveled, absent-minded professor-type teacher of American history back in my day at Akiba, wrote an obscure monograph called Akiba Hebrew Academy, History and Personal Reflections. This monograph was apparently the third in a series published by something called the Akiba Hebrew Academy Press Center for Educational Initiatives. Who knew there was such a thing? The monograph opens as follows, quote, Akiba Hebrew Academy, the first community-wide secondary Jewish day school in the United States, was founded in 1946 by a group of public-minded Jewish citizens who were deeply concerned about preparing students to assume responsibility in their community as leaders and active citizens. He goes on to write, it was the view of the founders that all Jewish children, affiliated and non-affiliated, should come together under one roof to study their common Jewish heritage while simultaneously learning to respect all positions and the devotion and sincerity with which they are held. This objective was not intended to blur differences, Dr. Gorvine wrote. Rather, it was intended to strengthen the Jewish identification of every student without compelling acceptance of one particular interpretation of what is the Jewish way of life. Akiba, it turns out, was the first community-wide Jewish day school in the United States. In its founding was an appreciation for the power of the Erev Rav, bringing together the mixed multitude of those coming from different walks of Jewish life, holding the space for a radically pluralistic and inclusive Jewish experience. 30 years later, nearly to the day, in fall of 1976, I entered Akiba as a seventh grader. Yeah, I stayed at Schechter through sixth grade. There is so much about my time at Akiba that to this day I recall, cherish, and hold dear, most centering around the amazing Morim I had, the teachers. They were an amazingly diverse group of educators who showed me the way, even when I was pushing back, misbehaving, and downright difficult. I am sure if they were here tonight, they would tell you that I was a hellraiser. It turns out that I was a straight A, three sport, leading play character, always in a male role, mind you, yearbook editing, Israel Independence Day parade leading, and so much more, hellraiser. I was also secretly struggling. True to the vision of its founders, Akiba was inclusive and pluralistic, but only if you were white, heteronormative, Jewish by birth, and from an in-married family. As I entered into Akiba, I started to feel that I wasn't passing the Sesame Street test. One of these things, me, was not like the others. I realized I was gay. I also realized I had to keep it to myself as I did not see my emerging reality reflected in any aspect of the school's culture and community. There was no GSA, that's for damn sure. And I will spare you all the faggot and dyke jokes that got thrown around unchecked day after day. I stayed in the closet through my senior year. I decided that Judaism and being gay were incompatible. I turned down the offer to the double degree program at Barnard and JTS, choosing only to enroll in Barnard for college. I came out of one closet and went into another. It took 10 years before I found my way back into Jewish community, finally integrating my gay and Jewish self. That was then, this is now. Having explored the Exodus, Yitzhak Mitzrayim, the counting, or Omer, and the teaching, Matan Torah, I want to finally turn to the future, your future, the redemptive charge. You are squarely in the middle of what sociologists call Gen Z. Your generation is deeply concerned about climate change, racial, and other forms of social injustice. And 70% of your generation wants a more activist government that will do more to solve our biggest problems. One third of your generation say they personally know someone who prefers to go by gender neutral pronouns, and roughly half say that gays and lesbians being allowed to marry is a good thing. Roughly 24 million of your cohort will be eligible to vote in the 2020 election. Your generation is a true Erev Rav, the most ethnically and racially diverse generation in American history to date. A bare majority, 52%, are white. Nearly 25% of your generation have at least one parent born outside the United States. Your time at Barak has been deeply steeped in Jewish values: kavod, honor, ometz lev, courage, chesed, kindness, and last but perhaps most important, kehilah, community. It is this last value I want to linger on for a moment before wrapping up. Diana Eck, a scholar of religious studies and the director of the Pluralism Project at Harvard, writes, quote, "Pluralism is not diversity alone. It is the energetic engagement with diversity. Pluralism is not just about tolerance, but the active seeking of understanding across lines of difference. Pluralism is not relativism, but the encounter of commitments. Pluralism is based on dialogue, encounter, give and take, and self-critique. I see Eck's poignant rendering of pluralism reflected in Barak's core value of kehilah, of community, particularly as expressed through the charge to respect and celebrate both your individuality and your diversity, your Erev Rav, your mixed multitudeness. It turns out lots has been written about Akiba Hebrew Academy. Historians seem to have a fascination with the origin story of this, at the time, radical experiment in Jewish education. In her doctoral thesis, The Reshaping of Jewish Identity, 1945 to 1960, my colleague, Valerie Thaler, spends an entire chapter on the history of the founding of Akiba. According to Thaler, choosing the name of the school was deeply symbolic, as it was taken from a Talmudic scholar and martyr during the Jews' struggle against Rome. Joseph Levitsky, chair of Akiba's education committee at the school's founding in 1946, was purported to have stated that Akiba's students would also, like their namesake, remain committed to Jewish life during momentous days in which they lived. I think we all can agree, graduates, parents, and your teachers alike, that there are no more momentous days than these. At Barak, you have learned to dialogue across difference, disagree without defaming, encounter and engage the other. You have had a remarkable education and experience, doing so all within the context of an Erev Rav. Whereas the Kabbalist Vital claimed that we would not be redeemed until we are cleansed and purified of them, of the Erev Rav, of the mixed multitude, Barak shows us that it is nothing short of our mixed multitudeness as a Jewish community that is redemptive in and of itself. You, in all of your individuality and your diversity, the Barak grads of 2020 possess the habits of hand, mind, and heart to lean in and to lead and to bring about positive change in our world today. I wish you every success.